Good morning. Can everyone hear me okay with the mic? Does it seem like the mic is on too?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So, because I know there's going to be people interested in hearing a recording of this. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't even need the mic, but here we are. So, welcome. Thank you so much for the opportunity to come before you this morning and then share a few hours with you with something that I am incredibly passionate about, and especially in trying to help equip churches to deal with addiction and to truly help people who are suffering from addiction. So I'll go ahead and start first with introducing myself and sharing who I am. So my name is Jim Berry, and my wife Cindy was able to come with me this weekend. And so thank you for helping us get out of Morgantown, West Virginia for a little while and share a nice date together. And I'm a ordained elder in the only Orthodox Presbyterian church in West Virginia, in Morgantown, West Virginia, and have enjoyed being a part of this family for a very, very long time. And Cindy and I are originally from, grew up outside the Detroit area, and went to Michigan State undergrad. And so if you are interested in basketball, I encourage you to root for the Spartans. went to my undergrad planning on becoming a doctor, and my interest at the time was actually family medicine. And that's, I was very interested as I went through my undergrad, and Cindy and I were part of a student Christian group there on campus, and that was very mission oriented. And so my plan was to become a medical missionary, was what I was hoping to do. And I figured that being a family doctor and going into family medicine would equip me the best to go anywhere and be of some value no matter where I went as a family doctor. So finished up medical school there at Michigan State, and then finished undergrad at Michigan State, and then got into medical school at Michigan State, and continued my family medicine interests. And the way it works is usually your last year of medical school is you apply to a residency, and that's where you go. And it's either anywhere from 3 to 6 years residency then is specific discipline. So I got into a family medicine residency at that time, again, in keeping with my plan. And the last rotation I had as a medical student, I scheduled to be a throwaway rotation that I could just basically call it in while I prepared for my residency. And it happened to be an addiction rotation with an addiction psychiatrist. So addiction psychiatrist is a psychiatrist who went through residency and then did a fellowship, another year of training in addictions. And so I happened to work on an inpatient unit with this physician and working strictly with people who had addictions and in the real heart of it, really, really bad addictions. And it transformed my professional life. And I realized through that experience what a rewarding experience it was working with people who were suffering from addiction, and developed a real heart for that, and was able to see people get better in ways that I didn't see in other rotations that I had. And I was able to spend time getting to know people in ways that I didn't experience in my other rotations. And so as a Christian, I recognized that there was a much greater opportunity and even sort of normalcy to talk about spiritual matters in the addiction world, as opposed to kind of somewhat taboo in other areas of medicine. And also, it helped me kind of confront my own understanding of the reality of our brokenness, and that when I saw these folks who were really struggling with addiction, I could also see my own struggles, not necessarily in the same way, but certainly my own fallenness, and was really interesting to me. So long and the short of it is, then I ended up Cindy and I moved to Morgantown, West Virginia, and because I was told that West Virginia University had a very great training program in their psychiatry program in addiction. And so that's how I ended up in West Virginia. Little did I know, so that was 2002. Little did I know that we in the United States were on the cusp of the worst addiction epidemic that our nation had ever known. And I'm going to get into some of these numbers and describe that in my talk. But I providentially had the opportunity of being on the in the front row of what, for those who don't know, West Virginia has led the nation year after year after year, and Appalachia as a whole, but West Virginia is the epicenter in overdoses by far away for the last 25 years. Mm-hmm. And so little did I know that I was going to have a front row seat and watch this unfold. And then with my colleagues and I, really try to come up with solutions to be able to curb the tide and help people stay alive and function. And so that's how I ended up to be where I am today. So I've learned a lot over the last several decades. And so now I used to run what we call an inpatient dual diagnosis unit. That was my primary job for a long time. And that's where I would have a unit, a hospital unit, and with several patients on there who had both addiction and then another severe psychiatric disorder. And so my job was to help stabilize them and get them well enough that they could get out of the hospital then and then continue on with their other type of care. So that's what that was my primary job, and this is at an academic medical center. So that's what I was doing for the longest time, but over years, somehow through bumbling and chance, or I guess providence and other technicalities, I found myself now in the head of the department that trained me. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm the chair of this department, and still do a lot of clinical work, but not nearly as much as I used to do. We're involved in a lot of research. We are involved in, so my department now is part of what's called the Rockefeller Neuroscience Institute. And we are involved in some world-class research now, first in the world research. Actually, our research was focused on, anybody watch 60 Minutes in here? So you saw 60 Minutes last month. They featured us and the work that we're doing. We're doing some deep brain stimulation surgery to help with addiction and some other work with addiction. And so that's taken up a lot of our time, and I enjoy teaching. So I still do a lot of teaching with medical students, with residents, but also I do a lot of teaching just in the community like this and town halls. I had the opportunity several years ago to go and speak before United States Senate and describe what was happening in Appalachia and addiction. And then also I speak a lot to other medical professional societies to help my clinician brothers and sisters understand, because there's still a lot of stigma regarding addiction in the healthcare field. And so I feel real called to do that. And then also churches, of course. And so I crave opportunities to get before people like you to help my brothers and sisters in Christ see the opportunities that they have to help your neighbors and to help actually your own brothers and sisters who are dealing with this. So that's really my goal. I've got, let's see here, kind of give you a frame. Let me start with this. How many people here know someone, a friend, family, neighbor who has addiction? Okay, pretty typical. How many people here know somebody of that nature also who has died from addiction, overdose or otherwise? Yeah, so for those who don't, who are listening to the recording, well, certainly more than half, and almost all know somebody who has addiction. And so it's a reality, right? I mean, this is an absolute reality, and we need to be better equipped to deal with it. Just to give you a frame of what we're going to be talking about. So if somebody, maybe Shane, if you can keep me honest as far as when I'm supposed to stop, because I understand we're going to go till, so right now it's 9 to 9:45, yeah, is that right? And then restart at 10 to 10:45, and then 11 to 11:45. That's my understanding, right? And so what I hope to get through in that period of time is talk about the epidemic of despair, and then what is the antidote to despair, What is addiction? Go through the terminology and also the history of what that means, addiction. Help everybody understand what's called the biopsychosocial and spiritual model of addiction. And then go through what are treatment opportunities, what are treatment options, what are the possibilities when it comes to treatment. So this is going to be much more of a practical, what are those treatment options, so that you can come away kind of giving knowing what the landscape is when you know that somebody is in trouble or you yourself are in trouble and you need to get help. This is going to give you a sort of a landscape view of how to do that. And then if we have time, and I never know, when I give these things, I never know how much time I'm actually going to get through, because I find myself just riffing for a while and then not sticking with what I wanted to say, but that's okay. The Spirit's in charge. So if we have time, I'm also going to go through opioids and the history of opioids, and then what does it do to somebody's body, and then the treatments, specifically what medications are available for people who are suffering from opioid addiction, or what's technically called opioid use disorder, and we're going to go through those terminologies as well. And then if we have time, then I'm going to talk a little bit about alcohol too, because what's the largest addiction that we have across the country, actually nationwide? What's the largest, what's the substance that most people are addicted to across the country, across the world?
Caffeine
is one. That's true. Yeah, that's right, actually. And then what's number two?
Tobacco.
So tobacco. And then number three is alcohol. And we still have, I'll show you the data as far as the opioids. So we have way too many people who are dying from opioids. And each year we're breaking every previous year's record where we thought, could it get any worse? Every year it's getting worse. But still, more people are dying from nicotine, tobacco-related issues every year that dwarfs the opioid problem. And then I'm really, really excited to be able to, at the end of the time, I hope just probably the last half hour, I'm thinking, maybe at least the last 20 minutes of our session, is to have, I've invited two of our members from church, a husband and wife couple, who are dear friends of ours, who have lived experience with addiction. And so I want to be able to have them come before you and then ask them some questions and allow you to ask some questions as well. In giving talks over the years, I find it to be the most powerful thing to actually have living, breathing human beings, where we take it out of just the theoretical and just the fact knowledge, and we actually have living, breathing folks who can kind of come before you and so you know, right? So you actually know somebody who's gone through this. So that's my goal. That's my goal for the morning. I want this to be interactive as much as possible. This is a nice, intimate group, and I don't want anybody to be shy about interrupting me or asking questions or throwing things at me or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty agile. One of the most important messages that I want you to come away with from this seminar is that this is not a hopeless condition, and that people get better. And so sometimes people ask me, how do you do this work? I was asked this last week. How do you do, well, we were on a trip, and sitting next to a couple on the plane, and they, one thing, I hate it when somebody asks what I do on a plane or something else like that, because then what's the first question that they say to me after I say I'm a psychiatrist? Are you analyzing me? All right, now we have to go through this whole thing. Probably same with you pastors as well, yeah. Right? But anyway, and then when they found out that I specialize in addiction, how do you do that? That's got to be awful. It's got to, you know. And no, it's amazing. I love doing this. I see people get better all the time. And unlike the other areas I had in medicine, it's 180 degrees different than what it was before. And not only that, not only do I get to see this person get better, but then I get to see their family get better as well. And I get to see their job get better, and their community get better, and their churches get better, right? And so it's incredibly rewarding. This is the main message that I want you all to come away with, is people do get better. People do get better. We are in a horrible, horrible state right now because people are dying at untoward amounts, at levels. and it's incredibly dangerous. And so that's really hard. But at the same, I've seen way, I can't even tell you the number of people that I know have died. And so that is incredibly hard. But the fact that people continue to get better keeps me doing what I do. Any questions then before we get on? Thoughts? Okay. Does this sound good to everybody? Does it sound like a good plan? Can everyone see this? All right, so Deaths of Despair. And this is a picture, it's a pre-Raphaelite picture. I think it might be in the Tate Museum. Oh shoot, you can't even, it's probably too unclear there. But anyway, take a look at that picture for just a little bit. And tell me some of the things that just come to mind or you notice about that painting.
Disorder?
Yeah, a lot of disorder, right? I mean, look at all the stuff, the clutter on the floor, right? The sheets off the bed, the blanket off the bed, shoes on the floor. So a lot of disorder. What else?
Very dark.
It's very dark, isn't it? And then you have this light open here and all the lights on the outside, but everything in here is dark. It's almost tomb-like, isn't it? It's almost like a tomb. Anything else?
I can't make out the condition of the plant in the window.
You know, that is interesting, isn't it? So the plant itself is alive. It's not a wilting plant. It's interesting, right? So it's actually alive, and there's a little flower that's blossomed on it. So that's an interesting pickup, because the pre-Raphaelites, if you're familiar with them, they'll use the plant imagery and stuff. But a lot of times it's wilting or dying, and they'll have some insects on there, but sometimes they'll also use this to just symbolize life. So there's life here next to the light, right? But here he is on the bed, and he's faced away from the light.
The window's open, the freedom he never achieved.
The window's open here, right? And so there's a freedom that he doesn't have here. John?
If he's passed, then he died alone.
He's solitary. Yeah. Yes. And this is a story, The Death of Chatterton. You can't read that, by Henry Wallace. So Chatterton was a famous poet of the day, sort of the Elvis of his day back in the 1770s, and he died by suicide. And then it just kind of blossomed his romance even further, the romantic notion of this guy back then. Any other thoughts?
Well, his body is not naturally positioned.
It's kind of twisted. Yeah, it is kind of a twisted body. It certainly doesn't look comfortable, does it, in the way he died. So he died alone. John?
I can't see detail, but is there any
sit up right here, John.
Thanks, Jim. My question is there any indication of how he died?
Correct. Okay, so we don't know for sure. However, it looks like there's a vial here, right? Apparently he did die from self-poisoning. And so it looks like there maybe he had a vial in his hand. He might even have a cap. And then it rolled away from his hand.
From his clothing, he's not poor.
That's a great point, you guys. That is a fantastic point. So you can tell from his clothing, right? Because who would wear purple? Right? So purple would have been, you know, more of a, a fop. Right, and so a dandy, so he was a wealthy guy, and that's an important thing, right? Is that addiction or the diseases of despair, the deaths of despair, which I'll talk about in a second, does not discriminate. So you have all seen, I mean, it's the celebrities, right, who get into the newspapers and the news who have died from overdoses, for instance, right? And they're incredibly wealthy, and people still die even if they have a ton of money. The other thing that I wish you can, because I don't think you can all see it from where you're sitting, but this is in London, and there is a skyline of London out there in the distance. And you can see St. Paul's Cathedral right here. Okay, so you can see St. Paul's Cathedral. And one of the things that struck me when I saw this was, here, this guy died, and he was in the shadow of the church,
right?
And there could have been an opportunity that the church had to bring this guy out of this despair. So deaths of despair, actually, before I get to that. Deaths of despair. Angus Case and his wife, Deaton, I forget her first name, Kathy Deaton, are economists out of Princeton, if I remember correctly, who about 10 years ago noticed a pattern, and then they published it, and I believe they got a Nobel Prize or something equivalent to that. But they noticed that Americans were, the life expectancy of Americans was shrinking over the years. Okay, I think it was started in about 2017, if I remember correctly. And it's gone down ever since. But the life expectancy of Americans was shrinking. People were living as a congregate, as a whole, a lot less than they used to. Every year since the Spanish flu epidemic in World War I, the life expectancy of Americans has increased until mid-2015, around there. And you would think, why on earth in America, with all of the resources that we have, all of the opportunities, all of the wealth that we have, that people are dying and not living long enough lives? Okay, how on earth could that be? And the answer is, it's not that people, older people were dying of some chronic illness like heart attacks at younger ages. Okay? It's the middle-aged group that were dying at record amounts that has been driving the life expectancy down. And it's not, you know, COVID, it's not some infectious disease. There are three main factors that have been driving deaths in America for the last 10 years or so. And what are they?
Suicide.
Take some guesses. One of them is suicide.
In fact, there were two in Gettysburg this week, apparently.
Two suicides?
In the obituaries this week. This is a small town.
Wow. It doesn't surprise me. And when anybody dies these days, and I see it and hear about it, and they're under 60,
yeah,
right, I immediately think of two things. One of them is suicide. Cindy knows this. One of them is suicide. What's another?
Overdose.
Is another. So I immediately, when somebody dies at a younger age, I immediately think, okay, this person died from suicide or this person died of an overdose.
How about all the accidents related to people being under the influence?
So those continue to increase, but that's a great thought, but it's not a main driver of those deaths. There's one more, and it might be a little bit harder for you to think about. It's liver failure. And why liver failure? Alcohol is one reason that people die from liver failure. What's another reason that people die from liver
fatty
failure?
Liver.
Fatty liver, usually from alcohol.
Obesity. Well, obesity.
And obesity. Yep.
Medications
can cause some liver problems, but there's something else that's related to addiction. Yes, again, it's going to be a little tricky if you're not in the healthcare field.
Stress
for sure. Stress affects the heart. Yes. Hepatitis. Okay. And hepatitis and cause. So people who inject drugs, and a lot of these drugs that are being used are being injected through a needle. And unfortunately, there's a virus called hepatitis C. And hepatitis C is in the bloodstream, and it's easily transmitted through the blood. And so when somebody uses a needle and they're infected with hepatitis C, then they're sharing that with someone else. They could contract that hepatitis C, and the hepatitis C kills the liver over time. And so liver failure is one of the big drivers of these deaths as well. All three of those, suicide, overdose, liver failure, are entirely preventable. But what Case and Deaton termed this is the diseases of despair, right? So these are all the diseases of despair. And so you could see, again, it might not be as clear for you all, but overall, this is since 1950, okay, and then 2000 especially, is the diseases of despair as a whole, suicides have increased, alcohol-related deaths have increased, and drug-related deaths have increased significantly from 2000 to 2002. You could just see the exponential sharp increase over that period of time. So that's been the term, the diseases of despair or deaths of despair. So what's the solution? What's the solution for despair and these deaths that are a result of despair? All right, so you guys, I see some of you writing. So I want you to pay very, very close attention to this. Okay, this is gonna be such a profound diagnosis that you're gonna wanna write this down. You ready for why this is happening? People are messy. Okay, people are messy. And that we're broken creatures. Not this guy. You guys know who this guy is? That's a different type. It's a different type of messy. Football or soccer fans we have here. What is this a picture of? The Garden of Eden. All right. And so what are some of the things that you see here in the Garden of Eden?
Harmony.
There's a lot of harmony there, isn't there? Right? I mean, look at this. Two lions, and there's a turkey right there. Right? Would you see that today? What else do you see?
Life.
Yeah, just an abundance of life. A lot of green, tons of different types of animals, flowers, beautiful birds. Yeah.
She's handing him the fruit.
Yeah, look at there. There's our leading servant, Adam, sitting down. Right? And so there's Eve handing Adam a fruit. And then what happens?
The whole picture changes.
The whole picture changes. How does it change? That's right. The whole picture changes. How does it change? In the back?
The lion eats the turkey.
Yeah. I probably took that bite, right? All of a sudden, that turkey lost its feathers.
They're forced out of the garden.
They were ultimately forced out of the garden. Yep.
Sin entered the world.
Sin entered the world. That's right. So then what happens?
Things got messy.
What's that? Then it got messy. Right? Then this whole thing got messy. Right, people got messy, the world got messy, sin entered the world, and what did it do? So, it caused, guilt, shame, broken relationships. So, previously there was harmony. Harmony is a perfect word for what this was. Okay, and so it caused broken relationships. What relationships did it break?
God made.
It broke the relationship between God and man, which is the most important relationship. Because prior to this, what was that relationship like with God and man?
Perfection.
They were walking together. They were united. There was no fear. There was no shame. They were naked, you know, physically, I suppose, but also metaphysically. And that, and thing to think about. They were vulnerable. Man was vulnerable before God and safe. Okay, so there's one relationship. What other relationship did it impair?
Man, and also man and the world.
Man and the world. Okay, so the relationship between human and other humans. Okay, so the relationship between this human and that human became immediately disrupted. What do we even we know that right away because what happens?
That woman you gave me.
Right? He immediately blames God for that woman you gave me. Okay, so it impaired that relationship. And then what else? What other relationship that John mentioned?
The first death was a murder.
The first death was a murder.
Children.
Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? So that relationship that became disrupted, the first manifestation of that disruption was death between those two people. Okay, so the relationship between God and man, between man and man, or human and human, between man and the world, okay? So before, what happened after the fall regarding man's relationship with the world?
He will toil by the sweat of his brow.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. So thorns and thistles grow up, and work is hard. And life is painful. We know that not only with the man, but also with
childbirth,
right? It was painful. There's two elements that are very, very painful now. There's suffering in the world. Okay, relationship between man and other men or women, between God, between the world, and what's another relationship that was impaired?
Creatures. Man with himself.
Got it. Between man and himself. Okay, that's the other relationship that got disrupted and impaired. And so this is the mess we find ourselves in. And so these diseases of despair we just talked about, they are a consequence of what happened here. And this is a consequence. I mean, this is just a reality that we have to deal with. And so when we think about sin and how sin impacts all of our lives, but even illnesses and addiction, well, yeah, absolutely, at its heart and its core, right, sin has impacted this. So alienated now, a dis-ease. Think about it, dis-ease. We are in a state of dis-ease or unharmony or disharmony. That'd be a good website, wouldn't it? It's like disharmony. Disharmony. Alienated to self, alienated to others, alienated to the world, and alienated to God now. All right. This is a great quote by a psychologist, Carl Elliott. On Prozac, Sisyphus might well push the boulder back up the mountain with more enthusiasm and creativity. I do not want to deny the benefits of psychoactive medication. I just want to point out that Sisyphus is not a patient with a mental health problem. To see him as a patient with a mental health problem is to ignore certain larger aspects of his predicament, connected to boulders, mountains, and eternity. Isn't that a great quote? Right? And so as we talk about, and as I am going to really implore you to understand the medical aspect of addiction, I also want to try to help you understand that all that we can do in medicine does not fix the human condition. And that we can fall in the trap of sometimes of over-medicalizing our human condition. Okay? So on one end of the spectrum, I want you to recognize the importance of common grace and what we in the medical profession can do and what our role is. But on the other hand, also at the same time, I want you to understand that that we don't over-medicalize normalcy in a fallen world, but also make sure that you know that you still have a role, even if you have a role as a Christian brother and sister, even though it may not be sufficient enough to deal with other things that they may need, but you still foundationally have that role. Does that make sense? You understand what I'm saying? So this is Edward Hopper. We are currently exist in an epidemic of loneliness, but what do you see in this picture here? Edward Hopper would like to paint with a lot of pictures.
No door.
There's no door, so you see this woman all alone, and it's just a window outside.
She's looking into an industrial world.
So you see this is an industrial world out there. Contrast that with the garden scene that we just saw, right? Is this a natural world for this woman? It's not a natural world, but it's more of an industrial world. Okay. What else?
Inside the room is analogous colors. Outside would be your primary.
Oh, that's interesting thought. Yeah. So inside this room, you see the different colors here, right? More of a pale, blue, cream, light. And then here you see more of the primary, more of a brighter orange, rust color. Anything else?
Somehow, besides the band, she put the colors, her red is different, but she is wearing red.
Yeah, that is kind of interesting, isn't it? Doesn't that tie a little? It is a different color. It's more muted color, but it does seem to be tied there. And I kind of think that, too, is this, she's probably one of these workers in this factory that we see here.
A lot of straight lines.
He uses a lot of straight lines, doesn't he?
She's the only one with any kind of...
He's a bit of a curve. Yeah.
She's on her bed.
She's on her bed.
She hasn't dressed for the day.
Yeah.
But right, she's still, bed doesn't look like she's
really
slept in.
Right. No, that's right, isn't it? That bed's fully made, so it doesn't look like she slept in that bed.
There's no personalization to
her. That's an interesting thought, too, right? So you don't see any pictures, right? No, you know, calligraphy with live, laugh, love.
Looks like a nice sunny day.
Yes, it's a sunny day outside, and here she is inside, and maybe she, you know, maybe the heat of the sun is on her right now. You know, maybe that's what she's experiencing. I don't know. You probably can't tell, but her eyes, I think, well, no, they're open. I was going to say they're closed, but no, they're open.
I wonder if the long shadows indicate the end of day.
Yeah, right. So that is that.
Early day.
Or sunset.
Gives me the feeling she's wishful.
It's morning sun, S-O-N. It's morning sun, S-O-N. Interesting.
She looks like she doesn't have any expectations.
Yeah, she doesn't, right? She's just there. And she's crossed and she's planted and set there. So not a lot of expectations, maybe not a lot of hope.
How old a woman is?
I can't tell, but I would suspect she's middle-aged to later age, looking at her face.
Her hair is up in the bottom.
Seems like she's wishful to be out there.
Yeah, you would think, right? Or maybe that's something that we're giving to her, right? Maybe that's something, because we would know, if we were in that position, we would want to be out there.
The position of her gray, which is right on top of her head, we know that the sun is going to shift.
Okay.
Is she going into more shadow or is she going into light? She's making a decision.
Could it go into either direction? So she's at the precipice of decisions that need to be made.
Her hair is up in the front. Or maybe she never slept.
Oh.
Never let her hair get hard.
Right. Right. Okay. You know, the other thing I think about is, what if we put a TV screen here, or a computer screen here? How would that change things? Just an interesting thought.
Certainly closes the room out.
Closes the room out, right? But how many people now are, like Hopper's, a number of Hopper's characters are, instead of looking out the windows anymore, are looking at computer screens? Minute by minute, day by day, et cetera, et cetera. So we live in an epidemic of loneliness right now. Vivek Murthy, who is the Surgeon General of the United States, the President's Surgeon General, was also the Surgeon General of during the Obama administration. And between the time of the Obama administration and the Biden administration, he spent going across the country and looking at a lot of data, but also doing personal one-on-one interviews with people and trying to figure out what's driving a lot of just disease overall, healthcare right now, and how can we make a difference. And he was shocked to learn that the number one factor that was contributing to health problems health disparities, but also health problems, like even cardiac heart disease or diabetes, obesity, but especially the diseases of despair. The number one factor was loneliness. And this was the element that we have people who are lonelier than they ever have been before. And do you take any guess about which age group is the most lonely now?
20s?
That's one guess. What else?
Seniors.
Seniors is another guess.
Kids, teens.
Little kids, late teens? Okay. So you were right. That it's 18 to 25 is the loneliest demographic right now. And when you look at the data, actually, it's so impressive that it's not, I mean, it's just so far and away when you look at the data with the 18 to 25, it really goes up to about 30. But 18 to 25 to 18 to 30 year olds, they're the ones who are the most lonely. They're the ones who report having the most anxiety, the most depression, the most suicidal thoughts. The seniors, they are more lonelier than they were before, but the seniors actually have a greater degree of life satisfaction, interestingly enough, in America still today.
These kids have the hundreds and hundreds of Facebook friends.
Well, isn't that ironic, right? Isn't that ironic? Is that still, when you would think where technology would have connected people more, it seems to have isolated more. And so there's a number of factors that I can go into regarding why I suspect that that's the case right now. All right, deaths of despair. What's the antidote to the deaths of despair? Here are the Humleys, folks. Here's Brian, yep. Brian and Stevie, and there's Shiloh. I would say there's three things, three antidotes to despair. One is hope, one is meaning, and the other is connection. So hope, meaning, connection, I am convinced, is the antidote to despair. Where do we find hope, meaning, and connection? Okay, we find hope, meaning, and connection in the church. And so again, I am 1,000% convinced that the church is placed in this, in all eras, right? But we've got such a great opportunity right now to be able to really help people in ways that they just have not needed such a great deal of help in so many numbers with their despair before. It is in the shelter of each other that the people live. That's an Irish proverb. So I'm going to go through ours. Go ahead. Oh, you're giving me the high sign that we're okay. I'm going to have to hurry up here. Actually, go ahead, Bert. You want to go through? Okay. All right. So I'm going to go through this anyway. So our story is Christ's story. Okay. Our story is Christ's story. And so a number of chapters in Christ's story, his incarnation. So he became with us through his birth and took on our human flesh. So he became, the Son became man. And then he became for us on the Christ, on the cross. And he took on all of the sin, all of the wrath, and all that we deserve on the cross that we may have life. And then through his resurrection, we are resurrected. This is all part of our story. So we are resurrected now, and we are set in the heavenly places before the throne of God, where Christ is there forever, in human flesh, in our human flesh, redeemed. And so are we. And then feast. And God saved us so that we may be with Christ and forever be able to enjoy him in pure fellowship. And the imagery of a feast is used over and over again to describe what that is like. And so we have the privilege of being able to live out this story and then also share the story with one another and share the story with our neighbors. This is Jeremiah 3, 14 and 24, 24. I will feast the soul of priests. I love this quota. I will feast the soul of the priest with abundance. and my people shall be satisfied with my goodness, declares the Lord. And Judah and all its cities shall dwell there together, and all the farm groups and those who wander with their flocks. For I will satisfy the weary soul, and every languishing soul I will replenish. So our greatest desire, should be to dwell with him. That is our greatest desire. We were made to glorify him, right, and enjoy him forever. And so we were made to dwell with him. And that the fact that we have desires, okay, which is part and parcel of addiction, the fact that we have desires is not a bad thing. It is a very, very good thing that we have desires. It's just our desires become misplaced. And our greatest desire should be to dwell with him. Kelly Caput, who I found great benefit from, is an author, theologian at Covenant College in Georgia. He wrote a book called Embodied Hope. I think I have a picture on it, one of these slides. It's a quote from that. Living within this story means that we strengthen our weakened sisters and brothers by drawing them to and reminding them of the word, presence, and action of the triune God, becoming avenues of God's grace and mercy. Life as God's people thus becomes the environment that sustains and nourishes those who suffer. Consequently, our examination of suffering will be holistic, with concern for both body and soul, mind and will, doubt and promise, frustration and love. Only such a holistic assessment will be faithful both to the cross and to the resurrection of our Lord. Thus, we maintain a realistic and honest assessment of pain and the radical subversive hope that declares our present suffering is not all there is. The Christian life requires not an individual people, but a people, the people of God. Only together can we believe, hope, and love amid our struggles. Isn't that a wonderful quote that really encapsulates in a lot? Okay, suffering is real. Unlike our Buddhist friends, okay, where suffering is and pain is just an illusion, that's not what we confess. Okay, we confess that suffering is real. So our role is not to escape suffering, but how do we live in suffering and help one another bear their burdens when they suffer? Okay? And also, our present suffering is not all there is. So we live, one of the ways that we are able to bear our current suffering is the same way that Christ bore his current suffering at the time, as he looked forward to the joy that was set before him, and knowing that that feast was there, and that we experience this now in an already sense with the church is such a blessing in that already sense, but then also in the not yet. We know that things are still not the way they are supposed to be, but we know they will be. And so that can keep us going. And that is the hope that we have. So the means of grace, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to stop here. And we'll take a break. And we'll see what we kind of get into after that at 10 o'clock. Thank you, everyone.